3, chapter 1, paragraph 3, I guess. I mentioned last time that the soul really has two parts. There is the nefesh, the animal soul, which all animals have, and man has also. And then there's the rest of the soul, which he sometimes translates as divine soul, upper soul in Hebrew, or transcendent soul. And by the way, if anybody's reading in Hebrew, one of the things my son pointed out to me a few years ago is that the word nefesh is used double. Sometimes the word nefesh for man refers to the animal soul. And sometimes the word nefesh is used for the lowest part of the higher soul. So it could be confusing if you don't pay attention and know what it's talking about. But at any rate, and the nefesh in man, the nefesh is connected to the body, is directed and influenced by the higher soul, which now is its nefesh, and therefore you have a connection from the upper soul through the nefesh to the body, and they're all linked together. And that's how it's possible for there to be interaction. We've spoken about this, especially in the evening series, that when things happen to the body, they are often registered in the soul, and when things happen in the soul, they are sometimes registered in the body. So there has to be some sense of connection between them. Now really, we speak of the soul as if it were one thing. But really, the soul has many different levels. The words that you often hear are nefesh, ruach, neshama. There's a 3 levels in Hebrew. Above that, there are 2 more that you hear less often, chaya and yechida. That makes 5. And then there are subdivisions. It's a very complicated entity, the soul. And he says, I can't explain this, I should just tell you what he says, that these parts of the soul are not bound together in such a way that they have to be always together. Some of the parts can detach themselves for certain purposes and then return. Or extra levels can be added to the soul and then disappear. So it's not constant. It's not a constant picture. And these goings on in the soul may have no impact on the body at all. The body may not feel them at all. They don't add or subtract to anything in the person's experience or feeling. Just that when he acts, the influence of his actions will be determined in part by how much soul there is behind it. And the proof of it, he says, is the extra soul that you get on Shabbos. You've probably heard about the Neshama Yaseva on Shabbos. Now he says it's something that you don't feel at all. I know that people from other traditions do talk about feeling it and what it means. But he says that you don't feel it at all. That's a proof that the Talmud says you get it, and we don't feel it. So he's telling you that's a good example of how the soul can have it. Change, substantial change, a receiving of an extra power, so to speak, without the body being aware of it at all. The Talmud speaks about a person who's lost in the wilderness and doesn't know, he's lost track of time, he doesn't know what day it is. What should he do about Shabbos? So, the rule is something like this. As far as Malach is concerned, one of the 39 forbidden activities on Shabbos, he should try not to do malacha every day, because that day might be Shabbos. If his life is in danger, then of course he can do malacha on any day, even if it is Shabbos. So he tries to minimize the amount of malacha he does every day. Still, if he does that only, that all 7 days of the week are going to be the same. All 7 days he'll try to minimize the amount of malacha that he's doing. What about a positive performance of Shabbos? So the halacha is that the Shabbos shouldn't be completely forgotten. 1 day a week he should set aside to do the positive aspects of Shabbos as well, like Kiddush. Which day should that be? So, there's a difference of opinion. One says that when the guy realizes he's lost track of time, doesn't know what day it is, he should count 6 days, and the seventh day he should make Shabbos. The other opinion is that the very next day he should make Shabbos. What's the difference? The one who says he should count 6 days and make the seventh day Shabbos, what is he relying on? What it says in the Ten Commandments. You 6 days shall you do your work, and the seventh day you should cease from doing malacha. The one who says that the very next day should be Shabbos, what is he relying on? Did you ever have such an idea that the very next day should be Shabbos? Did you have such an idea that's anywhere? Yeah, what about Adam? Adam was created on Friday. So the very next day was Shabbos. So this is a difference of opinion. There's all of which way to do it. To do it the way it says in the Ten Commandments, or to do it the way it says in the description of Adam. Nobody says, wait until you feel the extra soul, and then you'll know what Shabbos. Why guess? Very simple. You know? And you can use that for malacha as well. You do malacha freely and every day. When you feel the extra soul, bang, you'll know what Shabbos. Nobody says that. So, on our level anyway, let's take it for granted that we don't do it.
Yeah. Is it not a soul or an extension of the soul we've got?
The word in the Gemara is neshama yaseir, which means extra soul. Now, if once you realize the soul has lots of different parts, let me see what word he uses here. And he speaks of it as a thing. It arrives and it leaves. Previously in the paragraphs. Yeah, this is Vasco Avi Madrigos. Levels. Ocean. Yeah, he speaks of the fascios in plural. I would say it's an extra thing. That's the way it's being described here. Okay, so now the higher soul has access to certain interactions and experiences of things above, which again will not necessarily be felt in the body. Only sometimes. Sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. And maybe a little bit. You have a vague feeling about something. Or you have a sudden inspiration that you can't explain. The inspiration doesn't seem to come from anything that's happening around you. My Rebbe always points out, the Gemara says, every day a voice goes out from Mount Sinai proclaiming woe to the disgrace of the Torah that the people don't occupy themselves with it. Woe to the father whose children are abandoned, are banished from his table. So the Rebbe says, if this voice is proclaiming and nobody hears it, what good is it? What good is a voice? You know, that's a tree in the forest that falls, nobody's there to hear it. Is there a sound? Isn't there a sound? Which is pretty dumb. But all right, but and it's, I'm a philosopher.
The whole question in general, Stephen?
I think so. I mean, if the question means, is there an experience? If nobody hears it, the answer is no. If the question means, is there sound waves? The answer is yes. If it isn't that, then I don't know what the question is. I mean, it's, you know, sort of ABC. Now, give me a break. And if you have trouble defining sound, do you mean that's by sound? Does that sound one and sound two? Yeah? That's supposed to be a deep, deep matter of philosophy. Okay. I'm trivializing a little bit, but now so he said, what good is a voice that nobody hears? And the Rebbe said that When a person feels a sudden inspiration to think about his life, and to reevaluate, and to wonder where am I going, and how am I getting there, what are my values, my priorities, that voice is having an impact on him. It's shaking him up. Even though he doesn't hear it as a voice and identify it as a voice, but it is having an impact on him. That's something like what the Rambam is talking about here. Now, it can happen that when the upper parts of the soul interact with these higher realms, the influence can filter down and actually reach down all the way into the animal soul. And then a person may experience this as a dream. And now the Ramchal says something about dreams. And this is really, it's so rationalistic. It's like, if you're worried about being taken off into incomprehensible mysticism, where do dreams come from and how reliable are they? So in just a couple of paragraphs, this is what he says. A dream has many different sources. Number one, what you ate. Number two, what you experienced during the day. Number three, the interactions of this higher part of the soul in other realms. And number three, subdivides. Some of those higher realms that are accessible to the soul tell lies. So coming down from the soul to higher realms could be falsehood. And some of them tell the truth. And what you get is chillin'. You get a dream, and it's a mixture of all those different elements. What you ate, and what happened to you, your feelings, your fears, your hopes, and higher realms, some of which is true and some of which is false. You can imagine that there's a lot of shtuyot in dreams. A lot of nonsense in dreams. And there may be elements that are true. Of course, they don't come labeled true. You know, big T, you know. So, you don't know what to trust and what not to trust. Now, the ninth chapter of Brachos has several pages on the nature of dreams and what kind of signs there are in dreams. And there are people who, I'm told, do deal with these things. I don't really know anything about it. But I think once you have this background, you realize that you should not put a lot of stock in dreams. There is a phenomenon that has been documented. People will say, you know, I must be psychic because I dreamt something and then 3 days later it happened. So, you know, how many people does that happen to? I mean, you know, it's pretty detailed. What they find that in many of these cases is that these people have dreams all the time. The only dream that they remember is the one which comes true later, or they feel comes true later. Then suddenly they have a flashback and they remember that they dreamt it. But if you have lots and lots of dreams all the time, you know, sooner or later something's bound to happen that's similar to the dream that you had. The only way to test something like this, if you think that you're clairvoyant and you're having these dreams of the future, is every morning when you get up to immediately write down what you dreamt. And keep record. And then you'll find, I think, that the vast majority of them have nothing to do with anything that happens. Or you'll find that you have one of these misleading illusions that when the thing happens, you'll think, oh my gosh, I must have dreamt it. And you're just projecting backwards. By the way, anybody heard of deja vu?
Yeah.
Well, deja vu is really uncanny. You know, you have a sudden tug to the left. I've got to look over there, and you have this feeling, frog. You look over there, bang! There's a frog, and you think, oh my God, I knew it before I turned. You know, deja vu in Hebrew, in French means already saw, and I sort of knew before I looked that it was there and what it would be. Well, there is actually a physical explanation for this. When you look at the world, especially a peripheral vision, different parts of your brain receive the input at different speeds. And the conscious mind lags a little bit. There are other parts to which it goes, which the conscious mind doesn't get. So what you can have is, let's say, a frog glimpsed on the periphery of your vision, and you don't get the conscious visual image of a frog, You just get this vague feeling, frogness. Then because that part goes much faster in the brain. Then you turn your eye and see the frog, and you think that you had some kind of prophecy beforehand. But it's just pre-processing. It's processing beforehand from the visual image. It's just the order in which it's processed. So that doesn't have to be taken. I don't know. Good question. I don't know how it works with sound. But the picture we're getting is that higher consciousness takes a little bit longer to get to. So it could work with sound as well. You know, the lower elements of general category is one thing, and then the actual identification, the conscious experience of it will be something else. You know, loud, disturbing sound needing attention is one thing, and trumpet is another thing. And it may take longer to get the trumpet than it does to the prior. You can have this in lower animals, in frogs, as a part of the retina that responds to motion. That's all. Whatever it is, if it's moving, this thing fires. And if it's still, it doesn't fire. You have the juiciest fly. If the fly is sitting stationary, this part won't fire. You have a pencil going by, this part fires. I don't think the frog wants to eat a pencil. But its brain thinks it's worth a look. So we have to move aside and check whether it's a fly or a pencil. Yeah.
I heard of a thing called lucid dreams.
Where you're able to control the dreams.
Yeah.
Well, that's not so.
And if it's things coming down, if it's part of it is a higher realm talking to the soul, I mean, obviously you shouldn't be able to control that.
Well, you can control how you interact with it. You don't really. It depends on how lucid the dream is. You know, even in when you're awake, you can sort of daydream, and you allow images to flow through your mind, and sometimes you allow them to go by themselves, and sometimes you direct them. I think these are all the continuums, more or less. Yeah.
How can you get a dream from the higher world that isn't true?
There's a rule that we're going to see in the next two chapters or so, that God set up everything parallel with good and evil. Free will requires that there be choices. Significant free will, meaningful free will, valuable free will is the choice between good and evil. So at every level, there are choices between good and evil. Which means there have to be choices between the genuine and the counterfeit. Even prophecy, that when we get to the discussion of prophecy, there's something which could be regarded as counterfeit prophecy. And even on the higher levels, I mean, maybe the word higher is not the right word here. Let's say spiritual. There's a spiritual level corresponding to the levels of Kedusha. There's a spiritual level of Tumah. And they go up, side by side, up to a certain point. Overall, it's holy to the Creator. But below that, the created a side by side structure so that the person can have a choice between the two. And only in the end with the other side, which is its literal name. The other side will be will disappear. What is this? Okay. We're skipping chapter 2. If you read it, you'll see why I skipped it. Yeah?
You just said that there's good and evil, and therefore that's why there's true and false dreams. Everything has to have a good and evil part, but that's why it's true or false. Why is true necessarily good and false necessarily bad? If we define evil as being the absence of good, and saying that truth is good and therefore the absence of truth being false would be bad.
Okay, I'll do this briefly, but I think you're right. You're right there. Good. What we're really talking about here is emes and sheker. Emes means that which is real, that which is eternal. That's what emes means. Emes doesn't mean truth. The dictionary translates emes as truth. It's just another one of the many mistakes in the dictionary. Dictionaries are filled with mistakes. Emes means that which is ultimately real and that which is eternal. Sheker means that which is illusory, it's an illusion, a phantom, That's which is temporary, which is going to pass away. Now, the truth usually is emes. Lies or falsehoods usually are sheker, but not always. Not always. Those of you who have been with me in the Chumash here have heard a couple of times the principle that it is appropriate to lie for the sake of peace. There are several examples of this in the Torah. Lying for the sake of peace. When you lie for the sake of peace, when the lie is appropriate, the lie is emes. The lie is emes. I read this in Rav Vesper many years ago, and when I read it, I thought to myself, why are you doing that? What are you protecting? Why don't you just say that it's appropriate sometimes to use sheker? No, when it's appropriate to lie, you have to call it emes. Why are you protecting the word? Why is the word so important to you? I think I read the essay 5 times, and it frustrated me every time. Until I overcame my laziness, and I took out a concordance. You know what a concordance is? Concordance is amazing. It's every word in the entire Tanakh. Now, you can get the Evan Shoshan, which is made by the dumbest of all computers, which just picked it out by spelling. Boy, is that a mess. Then you can get the Mandelkorn. This guy Mandelkorn did it in the 50s, I think. He spent 10 years on it and went crazy. His son had to finish it. Every L, and that's different from the Aleph Lamed name of God. Every L in the entire Tanakh. And every one in the context of its verse. But his is organized according to grammar. So you'll have all the words sharing one root in one on the same pages. So if you want to know what a root means, you take out the book, and you look up that root, and you go through all the verses. It's fabulous. If you want to do any research, that's the book to have. You have to know Hebrew grammar, okay. But if you know it, it's all there. So, I took it out, and I went through emes, and I discovered something astonishing. The word emes in the Tanakh does not mean true. In the Tanakh. Not alone with Rav Dessler wrote. Because the vast majority of the time, the word emes in the Tanakh is used for actions. Actions are called emes. Actions are not true or false. You don't speak that way in English or any other language. An emes is the quality of an action. True is not a good translation. Furthermore, the Rambam, in Hilchos Perek Yud, chapter 10th chapter of the Laws of Repentance, says, someone who serves God out of love does emes because it is emes. And that bothered me also when I read it. He does emes? Is emes something you can do? And the Rambam was writing Biblical Hebrew, and he was writing it straight. Emes is something that you do. Because in Biblical Hebrew, that's what emes is. And we had to realize that Rav Dessler was literally correct. Furthermore, when the rabbis, when Chazal say that you should lie from time to time for the sake of peace, they never say l'shaker. They never use sheker. They say mishaneh. Mishaneh means to change. It means you're changing the facts. It's not sheker. It's not sheker. It's emes. That's why I don't say l'shaker. Furthermore, the Gemara says in Shabbos that the word emes has great stability. First of all, it's the first, middle, and last letters of the Aleph base. Aleph Mem Sof. Time for a footnote. The first, middle, and last letters of the Aleph base. How many letters are there in the Aleph base? 22. Well, there is no middle to an even number of items, right? So how could Chazal say it's the middle letter?
All the other...
See, Chibabi. You see Chibabi, yeah?
With all the other bays and...
Those are not different letters.
Yeah.
The final letters. Put the final letters in. There are 5 otiyot sofiyot. And you put them in order. Kaf, longa kaf. Mem, shlos mem, as they say in Yiddish. Right? Put them in order. And you'll find that the mem, the regular mem, is 14 out of 27. It is exactly the middle letter of the alphabet. Good. So emes is the first, middle, and last. Sheker is kufreshin. The 3 letters are exactly as close together as possible. The letters of Emmet, the Aleph has 2 points, the Mem has a flat base, and the Sof has 2 points. Sheker, they all come to a single point. They're ready to fall over. That's what the Gemara in Shabbos says. Now, what comes out? Huh?
Shin?
Yeah, Shin comes to a point. 3 branches out of a point.
Oh.
A real Shin, not the script Shin. Come on. Now, what is the Gemara telling me? So, in all those years when I took it so superficially, I thought the Gemara was telling me, here is a fact about truth. A fact about truth is that it stands. And a fact about falsehood is that it falls over. That's not what Chazal are doing. They're not telling me a fact about truth. They're defining Emes. This is what Emes is, not a fact about it. Emes is that which stands. Sheker is that which falls over. Comes out much better. The Gemara is telling me the essence of the idea, not just an aspect, feature of the idea. Anyway, again, I realize this is why you've heard me mention Rav so many times. One of the reasons I have such respect for him, because when you press what he says and look into the sources, you find that what he says is exactly true, and you can prove it. It's not just, you know, shooting the breeze. And I come from a non-Torah background. I have to have everything proved. You know, I mean, I'm not just roll over and play dead. I have to have it proved. Yeah.
I understand the problem. The word truth, when it's used in the context of something being true, it's based on the same word that's being used in action. You can do something that's true.
Not in English, you can't. You do not classify actions as true and false.
I seem to remember in literature, I'll try and find that.
Think of it in common speech. Tell me what would be a true action or be a false action.
When something is done that's real, I think it's based on the same thing. When something that's done and it's in either morally or whatever, or in the lines of whatever you're reading, if it's done and it's considered the right thing to do, then it could be considered truth.
What considered means, but that's not the way the language Am spoke, right? His giving of charity was true. Statements can be true, theories can be true, hypotheses can be true.
It was a true action.
Try it out. See what it means. It was a true action. What does that mean?
It means like the way you say MS is.
I don't think so. Find it anywhere you use that way in English. I don't hear what it means. Say it was a true action. And what would it mean to say it was a false action?
Honestly, I never. It doesn't seem right to say the other way, but it seems right to say that it was a true action.
Unless the word true is, you know, that's to say. Anyway, true and false is not normally used to classify actions. And if it is, then you have to understand it that way, not the way we understand it for propositions. And false won't be a good contrast. Anyway, on to chapter 3. Here we're talking about, when he says inspiration, he was Ruach HaKodesh, which is roughly, is literally translated as Holy Spirit, whatever that means, and prophecy. Now, this is very delicate, and since there are lots of claims about this stuff that are totally irresponsible, it's very important to get exactly what he says here. This is wonderful to put a basis on the ideas and to clarify and to be able to distinguish what's really going on and what isn't going on. It says, God ordained that man should have the ability within his very nature to learn, understand, achieve. Reason, intellect, it's hard words to translate exactly, as he examines the world around him and all of its aspects, all of its dimensions, and he can register things that are immediately apparent, and he can deduce information about what isn't going to be apparent. All this is given in the ability of his intellect. In addition, God set up a higher power of acquiring knowledge. And this is something which is due to direct divine influence. Because Baruch Hu will give him a special influence through various means which he prepared for this purpose. This influence will give him a certain knowledge with clarity, without any doubt, without any possibility of mistake. He'll know the thing thoroughly, its causes and its effects, everything on its own level. And this is called Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit. Now, when you get something with your natural intellect, it doesn't have all these qualities. Now, this Holy Spirit can give you information which you could have gotten otherwise. In other words, it doesn't have to be a separate subject. Through Ruach HaKodesh, a person can come to know where he lost his keys. He could also find his keys if he searches for them. It doesn't have to be a separate subject. It's the way in which the knowledge is acquired, not the subject matter. On the other hand, he can also gain information about things that aren't available to natural intellect, like what's going to happen in the future, or things that are hidden. And in this power, there are many different levels. How much you see, how far you see, how deep you see. However, one thing they all have in common is that the person who has it knows that he has it. There's no doubt in his mind where it's coming from. There's no doubt in his mind what's happening to it. This is something which comes labeled. It's an influence from God and comes labeled as such. So that if a person has a great inspiration and a great excitement and he has a very powerful dream and he wonders whether or not it's Ruach HaKodesh, that already kills him. If you're wondering, it can't be right. There can't be any wondering. It comes labeled as such, absolutely.
Would someone that has a Ruach HaKodesh be looking for his keys with it?
I don't know if he can control it at all. It's not a question of what you do with it. It's not like a searchlight. It's that things are presented to you as information and you know where they're coming from. It's not under your power, of course, I know. You are just affected by it. Maybe you can seek it out, but I don't know if you can seek it out. Well, no, maybe there are cases. But they don't use the keys, that's true. That's not true. There are cases that are mentioned.
Is it Ruach HaKodesh looking into the future?
Not always. Not always. He says it could be something which you could possibly discover with your own mind, just as presented to you through Ruach HaKodesh. Or it could be the future, or it could be something that's in the present, but inaccessible normally. Could be anything, any of those factors. Not always the future.
Could it be false?
No, it can't be false. It can't
prophecy.
Be doubtful. What?
It's not that prophecy.
Prophecy can't be false either.
The full prophecy is that evil also.
No, I said that when this, I said this pseudo prophecy or counterfeit prophecy. On every level, they have to be parallel. So there's genuine prophecy and something else, which is a competitor to prophecy.
Which would become labeled as.
You're right. He's just jumping at it, but he's very logical. And it comes labeled, so how then can it possibly be a counterfeit? The answer.
You can't choose that.
No, you're guessing. The answer is this, as he will say, the two chapter sentence. There are two kinds of prophets. There are prophets in training, and there are graduate prophets. A prophet in training could misread the labels. He could misread the labels. And the test for him is, if he had such an experience, coming with a blurred label, and he's sort of trying to, you know, look through the water thing to try to figure out what it is. That if you go to a graduate prophet and say, listen, here's the quality of experience that I have, I can't read the label, tell me, is it genuine or isn't genuine? If he does that, the graduate prophet cannot make a mistake. He could lie, but he can't make a mistake. The graduate prophet could knowingly, evilly, solicit the wrong side and have the experience. He could do that too. But he can't make a mistake. So if the Yetzer gets hold of him and he says, I want that experience for whatever reason, he can do it. But the labels can't be mistaken. On a lower level, a prophet in training can indeed make a mistake. And he'll give an example from a very famous prophet who made such a mistake. Prophets whom you all know, a story you all know, but you just haven't heard it described that way because I didn't know about it this book either. I didn't know that was the case. Okay? Yeah.
Are you saying that these are the only two ways of acquiring knowledge, or have I just put that in?
What, natural intellect and Ruach HaKodesh?
Yeah.
Well, there's also prophecy.
Right.
But let's see, what else? Other than natural intellect, Ruach HaKodesh and prophecy?
Emotional knowledge?
Like, what about, like, an inner knowledge of, I think you might have mentioned before, like, your own existence or something like that? That's not Ruach HaKodesh.
Well... Oh. Intellect here, I see what's happening here. You're taking the word intellect to mean roughly mathematics. This is a sensitive issue. I'll go into it a little bit, but you'd have to do a whole philosophy on this. What about intuition? Just feel it's true.
Is it more modern or like instinct?
Okay, call it instinct, I don't mind.
Yeah, but then it wouldn't be like intellect.
Well, let's see. Is there any way in which it would be appropriate to trust intuition or instinct?
Well, does intellect have anything to do with free will?
Maybe, but let's answer this question first.
The difference between intuition and instinct.
I'm not okay. Worried about that. I don't want to fight that battle right now.
I thought you're making a difference between
the two. I'm not. He mentioned this. I said put that in too. We're put it all in the pot. I don't mind. Okay. What would there be any way in which instinct or intellect, intuition would be trustworthy? Is it always trustworthy? How should we deal with intuition? You know, intuition's gotten a bad name. It's really sort of a throwaway, especially when you talk about feminine intuition. Boy, that's a real put down, right? Bad enough for women, but say it to a man, it's all over. I think this is all a mistake. By the way, in an older English, intuition was a name for sensation. There was visual intuition and auditory intuition. I suppose by looking around, you can get genuine information about the world, can't you? And by listening to things, you can get genuine information about the world. But what about a feeling? I just feel it so. Now, if you keep track of all the things you feel are so, and see how things work out, you may find that when you feel it so, it's so. You may indeed, your intuition may be plugged into the real world, and it may work accurately and regularly. If you keep track and you find that your intuition leads you to the truth a good percentage of the time, then you should trust it. Because it's been verified by your intellect that it too is a source of knowledge. It doesn't have to be perfect, but if it's much better than guessing, then it's worthwhile to take seriously. If, on the other hand, you keep track and you find that it's no better than chance, so then you have checked and you have found that your intuition is not connected to reality. And this will vary from subject to subject. For example, there are people who intuitively understand other people. They look at the guy and they say, he's worried, or he's nervous, or he's depressed, or he's sleep deprived, or, you know, like after my student. Or, and other people will look at the same guy and think that you must be a prophet. How do you know what's going on inside of him? So then you ask the guy, and it turns out this guy's right. He's right 9 times out of 10. That's amazing. He perceives it. He just sees what's going on in the other guy's feelings and the other guy's mind. No, that's a kind of intuition, or if you don't like the word, I don't care what word you have. He feels that it's so. Now he checks by testing, and he sees that it's so. It's no different from wine tasting. How does this guy know that it's Beaujolais from 1922 from the north side of the vineyard? He just tastes it, and he gets used to tasting it. That's how it tastes. I mean, it all tastes the same. I can't tell a Beaujolais from a Merlot. Yes, I can, really. But all right, you know. So that being the case, you just get used to it and you test it, and if it tests accurate, there's no reason why you shouldn't use it. It's another access to knowledge. Now, you want to call this intellect? I don't mind. But the intellect has to certify it. Here's the key word, the key idea. The intellect has to certify it as accurate. If the intellect certifies it as accurate, then there's every reason to use it as part of your, especially in psychology, in therapy. What does this person need? Even people who perceive together the same problem, most people will look at it and say, I don't know what to do about it. And some people will say, this is what he needs. It's this kind of interaction that he needs. How do you know? I know. Trust me. And it works. They just know. Now, how they know, I don't know. But if they try it out and it works 8 times out of 9, they're worth talking to. Because if you'll try it on your own, it won't work 2 times out of 9. So I think that that's all part of your natural ability to know things about the world. As long as it's certified by the intellect, then it's that all the time. It's accurate. Yeah.
Do you use intellect to gain knowledge?
Yeah. Sure, of course. Yeah.
Just one example I was thinking of. Like, when the baby's in the womb, you know, and there's Kulthoras, and then when you're learning later and you've got kind of a sense or a feeling that it's true, or for that, I remember learning or hearing somewhere in a shir about that, and that's, you know, that's true to those things. Is that like an inner sense of...
It could very well be. The trouble is, when you have that feeling, there'll be no way for you to tell whether that feeling is coming from what you learned in the womb, or whether it's coming from imagination, or it's coming from a novel you read. That's why, you know, it's definitely there. I want you to know, part of the background for that Gemara, that statement Chazal, is that how could a being, like a human being who's so limited by his body, I told you a couple of times that the soul has all its powers crushed, it has all of its powers reduced, so as to be able to interact with the body. And its ability to gather information about the world is limited to the body. How could it learn Torah? How could it be relevant to Torah? So, what Chazal is saying in part is that it has to have an infusion of Torah beforehand, so that when it comes to Torah in this world, it's coming to its second time around. Now, that sounds so very mystical, but let me tell you something. In science, when scientists are cooking up theories to try to explain how things work, for every set of data, information, experiments, observations, there's an unlimited number of possible theories, all of which fit the data. I talked to you about fitting curves once, having dots on a graph, drawing wavy curves. For any amount of evidence, there's an unlimited number of theories, all of which fit the evidence. How do we pick the one that we feel is worth going with? Because the other ones are clearly crazy. Why are they clearly crazy? Because something in our minds classifies these theories and says, yeah, that's it. And the other ones are bunk, leave them alone. So they talk about simplicity. Yeah, right, terrific. Simplicity is a word. But no one has ever given a definition of simplicity, and no one has ever given an explanation why we should pay attention to simplicity. Many feel there has to be some kind of pre-arranged agreement between the way the mind thinks and the way the world works. Otherwise, just trusting this hunch, this feeling, yeah, that's got to be it, wouldn't get you anywhere. You'd be wrong as many times as choosing by random in terms of all those theories would be. So they try to explain it on the basis of evolution. Evolution explanation is poppycock. Nobody really understands why it should work the way it does. But it seems to work that way, because otherwise our choices of theories to bet on would be wrong almost always. And they aren't wrong almost always. They're quite often right. Which, if we're random, it shouldn't be. So it does seem like there's something in the mind, however you explain it, there is something in the human mind which does fit the way the world works in very deep ways. Ways that you didn't learn as you played with pebbles when you were a child, you know, as you made mud cakes on the seashore. It's not that kind of thing. So, our picture is a picture of where it's prearranged that there should be a connection between the mind and the Torah. I'm just pointing out that such an idea isn't such a fanciful idea in general terms. At any rate, this is the crucial thing about Ruach HaKodesh. It means that anybody who has a very powerful experience cannot attribute it to Ruach HaKodesh, unless it comes labeled as such. My Rebbe once said to our oldest daughter, when she was 7, I guess, she asked whether he had Ruach HaKodesh. She asked us. So we said, ask the Rebbe. So that's what we do. You have a question like that. So she asked the Rebbe, and this is what he said. Anyone who says he has it, doesn't. And that's all he said. So, and then you have prophecy. Now, the key thing, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, the key thing is to distinguish between prophecy and Ruach HaKodesh, not just externally, in terms of power and insight and clarity and so forth and so on, but internally. What is the internal difference in definition? Can I suggest you might read ahead? No, that's too radical. But if you should happen to be, have nothing to do for a half hour, and you do read ahead, look carefully, you might pick out the key two or three words which define the ultimate difference between Ruach HaKodesh and the Ruach and prophecy. We'll talk about that tomorrow in the session.
What's that?
You want to know the difference between instinct and intuition. I think that instinct is more of a reaction, and intuition is more of a feeling.
Your instinct, especially you, is something that you are pre-programmed with. Do you mean programmed to the